I was just kind of going through the Bible this week, trying to figure out what I want us to focus on and what God is leading me to teach. And it's a book in the Bible that he's not really led me to teach on before. And as I was going into it, it started to become quite clear why I felt like this is where God was pointing me. And where he's pointing me is to the book of James. How many here have read the book of James? No shame. So many of you have probably heard many verses from James. It's a great book. And what I started to get out of James is something interesting. When you guys think of wisdom books, what books come to mind?
Hebrews, Ephesians,
Proverbs. Psalms, maybe. I think of Job, Proverbs, Psalms. Those are all books of wisdom, and most of them are what? In the Old Testament, right? And so what's kind of interesting as I was reading James, it started to remind me that, man, this is a book of wisdom in a sense. It's full of sayings that help us to live our lives according to God's pleasing will. Now, I'm going to give you some background because I think it's important as we study the Bible to understand what it is we're looking at and why it's written and who it's written by. And so the first thing to know is that James is a book in the Bible called an epistle. Anybody know what that word means? An epistle? A testimony? Nope.
A letter.
It's a letter. It's a form of writing in the ancient times. And it comes from a Greek word that means epistle. And what that is it's basically a letter. And it's a letter to, in the New Testament, either to a church, a group of people, or an individual. And so James is what we call an epistle. And anybody know how many epistles are in the New Testament? Any Bible scholars here? 21 letters in the New Testament. You know how many of them Paul wrote? Most of them, yep. He wrote 13. Pretty amazing. Paul was a busy guy. So the epistles are, and I'll read these off real quick just for knowledge, Romans, Hebrews, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, 1st and 2nd Peter, James, the book we're in today, and Jude. Those are all considered letters. They're epistles in the New Testament. And the thing I loved about James is it's very different from any of the other epistles that you'll read in the New Testament. Hebrews is somewhat similar, but to me, James is a wisdom book about Christian living, how we should live our lives, how we should conduct ourselves, the things that we should be focused on in our minds and our hearts. Now, what you'll learn about James is it often reflects on the exact same things that Jesus said, many of his teachings. So if you guys have your Bibles or you have your YouVersion app, there's an event created on the YouVersion, or you can turn to James 1 in your Bible. Did everybody find the event that's looking for it? You want a Bible? Yeah. You're welcome. Anybody else? You want your... So we're going to be in James 1 today, and if somebody wouldn't mind starting off by reading James 1:1. Any takers?
James, a slave of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in dispersion, greetings.
Thank you, Dan. So the reason I point this verse out, first of all, is it's very important. What you'll see in most epistles is they identify the author, who they're writing to, and oftentimes the intent of the letter. Sometimes the intent is in the very back, and so is who wrote the epistle. But in this case, the author is identified as James. Well, James who? That doesn't tell us a whole lot, does it? So, anybody know how many apostles were named as James?
Two.
Two apostles. There's James, the son of Zebedee. And James, the son of Zebedee, according to Acts 12, was martyred, and they think he was martyred around 44 AD. There's another James, the son of Alphaeus, that's listed in the New Testament, and there's very little that we know about this James. He was not outspoken. There's very little text about him. Many scholars believe that this James that wrote this epistle was actually the half-brother of Jesus, his brother James. And what there's actually some text in the Gospels about this brother, and you'll notice that in the Gospels, he didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ. He didn't believe that his brother was who he said he was. But later on, he comes to accept that his brother was the Messiah, and he becomes a very powerful church planter and leader after his crucifixion and resurrection. And so we believe that this epistle was written by the half-brother of Jesus. Growing up together, you probably get to know your brother pretty well, and you hear the things that he says. And so it's pretty cool to have a letter from somebody that close to Christ himself. Now, many believe that this epistle was written before 50 AD, making it one of the earliest epistles in the Bible. So now we have some content and context around James, who he is. Now, what about the audience? So as we just read, it says he's writing to the 12 tribes scattered throughout. 12 tribes of Israel. So is he writing just to Jews? If you look into James in detail, you'll see that he's writing to Judea Christians, people that have accepted Christ, these Jews that are persecuted and scattered amongst the area. So these are scattered, persecuted Jewish Christians that James is writing to. And what you'll learn is this letter is written to encourage them during their time of trial. It's a letter to encourage them to stand firm in their faith. Firm in their faith. And if you ever start to be in a position where you're having doubts about your faith, or you're just getting stale in your faith, it's a good book to go back to be reminded of why we need to stand firm in our faith. So let's take a look at the next couple of verses now. If somebody would read James 1, 2 through 4.
I will.
Okay.
My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So these verses 2 through 4, it's a good reminder that the suffering that these people are going through is not pointless. There's actually purpose in their suffering. And it's a reminder to each of us that sometimes we do go through suffering, and there is purpose in that. God allows us to suffer at times for his good purpose. You know, a lot of times we want to just ignore and get away from any possible pain we can. But sometimes that pain helps us more than you realize. When I have pain in my back, for example, and it starts to flare up, it reminds me that I need to take time to take care of myself, and I need to persevere through that. You see, through suffering, faith increases. Most people that have come to faith as an adult, usually it comes out of suffering of some kind. Anybody disagree with that? As adults, we've been through a lot. We've seen a lot. We've seen suffering in the world. We've probably been through some trials of our own. And it's usually during that that our faith begins to increase when we turn to God. Through suffering, perseverance increases. We begin to persevere. We learn endurance. We learn how to just push through those trials. We push through. And when perseverance is developed, we begin to mature. We begin to mature, and mature is the outcome of long-suffering. If you're a Christian, a believer, and trust God through this suffering and know that He's at work, He is maturing us, He is developing us in our faith. And that's what James is saying to these people that are being persecuted, driven from their homes, afraid for their lives, running and scattered about all because they gave their life to Christ. All they did was give their life to Christ, and here they are being persecuted. And this was no surprise to God. God knew this was coming. God, I'm guessing, preordained that persecution because of that, their faith began to increase. They began to mature in their Christianity, and from that, the entire world was exposed to Christianity. Now, if we look at the next couple of passages, which Carol started in, verse 5 through 8, does anybody read that?
I got it.
Okay.
If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave on the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do.
Thank you, Justice. So there's two themes in this little bit of text here. The first theme is that we need to seek God's wisdom. And the second theme is we need to believe when we ask God. We need to believe. So let's look at seeking God's wisdom and the importance of that and why He's telling them to do so. Now, we all know what wisdom is. We all know somebody most likely that we consider wise, right? Well, wisdom, according to the dictionary, is knowledge of what is true or right, coupled with just judgment as to action, discernment, or insight. Somebody that's wise can discern what's true, what's not true. Somebody that's wise will judge fairly. Somebody that's wise will speak truth. Wisdom should be sought by every believer. You guys all know the story of Solomon. God said, ask me anything and I'll grant it to you. He was playing a trick, I think, on Solomon. Solomon's like, oh boy, what should I ask for? He could have asked for the riches of the world. He could have asked for a new Mercedes. He could have asked for anything. And what did he ask for? He asked for wisdom. He said, God, grant me wisdom. Why? I think he was already wise in the first place. God made him the wisest person in the land. Because with wisdom, he could rule fairly. He could rule justly. He could discern what was right and wrong. And he gave him wisdom to shepherd his people. Wisdom is key in the believer's life. In Proverbs 2:6, I'm going to read this. It says, for the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. It's something we need to seek on a daily basis. God's wisdom. God's wisdom. God is all-knowing. He's all-wise. You know, we're eager to seek our wisdom from TV or seek our wisdom from the self-help books and all of these things. But there is no wisdom like God's wisdom. When it comes to wisdom, God is ready to give it. We just need to ask Him. It's very clear. Ask and believe that He's going to give you that wisdom. That's what James is saying. Get wisdom. Now, the theological term for God being all-knowing is omniscient, okay? If anybody has the Bible app open, would you read Isaiah 40, verse 28? New version?
I can get it.
Okay.
Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all. Of the ends of the earth, He will not grow tired or weary, and His understanding no one can fathom.
Thank you, Kim. Nobody can fathom His understanding. He's not bound by the things you and I are bound by. We have a finite ability to learn and have knowledge. God is infinite. He's infinite. And if He's that knowledgeable and knows everything there is to know, why wouldn't we want to turn to Him to get wisdom? There are many ways in which God departs wisdom into us. One of the ways is through His Word. And that's what James is doing, even though he's saying go to God for wisdom. He's giving us wisdom at the same time, very godly wisdom in his book. And so all through this Bible, we learn to gain wisdom of the Most High, the wisdom that He's exposed to us in writing. And then there's this divine wisdom that comes upon us when we request it from God. Every time I'm going to study His Word or I need help in a situation, the first thing I do is I turn to God in prayer. I say, God, give me Your wisdom. Make me wise in this situation so I can govern or make the right decision over this situation. And I'll tell you what, there's things that come to me that I can only accredit to God. On my own devices, I would have never come up with that. He'll give it to you. You just have to ask. Proverbs 8:11, it says, "For wisdom is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire can compare with her." Solomon knew that. He knew the significance of having that wisdom and the power of allowing him to be wise and govern according to God's good plan. You know, I think of Adam and Eve in the garden. And if Eve would have just asked for God's wisdom in that situation when she's being tempted by Satan, I think the course of mankind would be on a different course. But instead, she chose the wisdom of Satan. And it sounded good, it looked good, but in the end, it destroyed her and her husband. God's wisdom is pure, it's good, it's holy. It guides us into all righteousness. It helps us to judge correctly. So let's always be going to God for that wisdom. Let's move on to James 1, 9 through 11 now. Do I have any?
I'll read it.
Go ahead.
Believers in humble circumstances ought to take pride in their high position. But the rich should take pride in their humiliation, since they will pass away like a wildflower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. It blossoms, falls, and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich will fade away even while they go about their business.
Thank you, Robert.
This is a theme that we read over and over throughout the Bible. Jesus often talked about the humble. Jesus often talked about the rich. James considers the humble in this verse to be above the proud, to be above those that are high esteemed. This very trait of humility and humbleness is a trait of Jesus Himself. God Almighty in the flesh humbled Himself gave up his divine dwelling to come and be with us. And the ultimate humility that he took was on the cross. We often look at humility as him washing the feet of the disciples. But the real humility that he took on for us was on the cross. It's a trait that we should follow, being humble. So in today's world in which we live, what, and I'm going to open this up to you guys, what do you think humbleness and meekness look like? Throw out some examples of what that might look like today.
Putting others before yourself, serving others.
Okay.
Not judging.
Okay.
Not striving to be the most powerful and the most well-to-do, the most, you know, person on stage for everyone to look at, like a lot of people do.
Right.
Lack of greed, sharing.
Yeah.
Giving.
Absolutely, Kim. So those things haven't changed over the centuries. It's not a new concept. It's an attitude that we must take on to walk with Christ. Meekness and humbleness. Why do you think this is a struggle for some people? Any thoughts?
Pride.
Anger.
You're talking about Christians or non-Christians?
Christians. I think it's a struggle.
Christians today, sometimes there's a lot of them that just listen to the world. They listen to this prosperity stuff, and they think they're supposed to be, I don't know, have everything, that God's promised them everything right in this world.
I think a big problem is we haven't learned to let go of self and trust God. We're concerned with our own self and our own desires, and they don't line up with God's will. And so we want, and we're so inward focused that we start to take on the sense of self-righteousness, the sense of pride, the sense of things that...
Attention-seeking,
I mean, you name it. We need to put our focus back on God, humble ourselves before him. When I think of humble people, I think of Psalm 25:8. It says, he guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his ways. Humble people are teachable. They're teachable.
That's exactly what I was just thinking.
Right?
That if you're teachable, then you are humble because you're willing to learn.
Absolutely.
Because you don't know it all.
Absolutely.
And you know you don't know.
You know you don't know it all. We need to be teachable. Even if we think we know everything there is to know, you'd be surprised at how much you can learn by just humbling yourself and listening to what others have to say. And that's where wisdom comes in as well. See, the wise are teachable. They're willing to learn. They're willing to acknowledge that my view is not the only view in the world, and we need to be open to hear what other people have to say. There are so many lives and so many experiences in this world that we can learn from if we'd be humble. Humbleness allows God to teach us. Allows us to be open to what God would have for us. It helps us to recognize our dependence on God. Humility says, God, I need you. Humility says, I cannot do this on my own. I need God in my life. Humbleness places the needs of others before ourselves. You know, I was just thinking of an example with the gas situation we had a few weeks ago. I wonder how many of those people were Christians that were cutting other people off in line, right? It was definitely humility at its worst, or humanity at its worst at times. You know, what if the person in front of you that you were getting angry with because they were jumping in to get gas, had an emergency, and they really needed gas. I mean, there are so many things that went through my head as I'm sitting in line for gas, thinking, you know, each of these people have their own situation going on. What if I let somebody in front of me? How would that look? What would that do? What would that say to them? What if I quit worrying about myself and started worrying about others and put their needs above mine? Because I serve a great God, and He says He's going to take care of my needs. Why am I worried? The humble learn to give God the glory and honor that He deserves. Too many people try to take credit for things that God has done in their lives. Look at me, look at what I've done. I earn this, I earn that, I deserve this, I deserve that. Do we? Do we really deserve anything if you look at God's standards? We deserve judgment, we deserve condemnation. But because of God's grace, He saved us. Now, in contrast, let's talk about the proud for a minute. Remember in James 1:10, he says the rich should take pride in their humiliation. You see, this attitude of pride, it says, I don't need to be taught. I know everything. Don't teach me. I know it. I know. And I'm not trying to throw them under the bus, but on this trip to Europe, I saw a lot of that going on with my parents. You had two people that knew everything, and they could not be told what to do or who was right. And so we had this little arguing going on at times, and it's like, oh, Lord, don't let us get like that, Cindy.
You can't
between the two? Yeah, between the two of them. They were both right, but they were both wrong. And they would sit there and battle each other over who was right. It's an attitude of, I'm right, you're wrong, no matter what. And I'll tell you what, problems don't get solved that way. There's always negotiation. There's always learning the other person's side of things, where they're coming from. But pride rejects that completely. Pride says that I am better than others. I'm better than you. I'm better than others. Look at them, look at me. You never saw that with Jesus. You never saw any pride in Him whatsoever. It says, I deserve this or I deserve that. Pride says we do not need to be dependent on God. One of the things that really became clear to me in Europe is the sense of the Holy Spirit was not present anywhere. And you look at how those nations are governed, it's a socialist government. You don't have health care, you get health care. If you are below a certain wage, they subsidize your wage. Everybody's taken care of, they have all kinds of housing available. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe that's why, because all their needs are met. That's why I've said many times the middle class don't need God. And it's the hardest group of people to evangelize to. Pride says,
do they go to prison?
Huh?
Do they go to prison?
Well,
I think it's because they have no sense of struggle.
Okay. That's exactly right. So that's why we should consider it pure joy when we go through trials of many kinds. Because it's through those trials that we begin to persevere in our faith. So when we begin to mature, as I was saying earlier, trials develop our character, they develop our nature, they help us to be more and more dependent upon God. When we see these horrific storms coming into the U.S., as hard as it is to watch, I know that good will come out of it. I know that that's a time where a lot of people start to seek God very quickly. All right, all your stuff's gone. Now what are you going to do?
away what you worship.
It's true. The next thing we learn is that if you want to be lifted up, then we need to humble ourselves. In James 4:10, skipping up a little bit ahead in James, it says, humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up. Humble yourselves. What is better, to elevate self or to have God elevate you? I would much rather have God elevate me in my humble situation and let his glory be known. He goes on to talk about the wealthy. You'll read in the Gospels, Jesus points out the wealthy many times. He says, easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for the wealthy to get in heaven. Why does he say that?
Because the wealthy have no dependence on God. They think they've got everything they need. They don't need God.
That's right.
And so there's no purpose for... How are you going to go look for God and get to where his home is if you have no need for him?
That's absolutely right. So what's interesting to me is I've encountered people many times that say, life is short. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to get everything I can out of this life. And what is it? That's a self-centered attitude, right? It's about me. What can I get? For a Christian, life is not short. Life is everlasting. And this is just a blip on the radar of an everlasting life. And so we start to seek the things of the kingdom instead. When we get to heaven, we will need nothing. We'll be in the presence of God.
Reminds me of the story that you told earlier with the rope.
Yeah, absolutely. The little 20-foot rope with the little red speck on one end. Says, this is our life on earth, and this is eternity. Why would we spend all our time focused on that red dot? We do. We tend to get so caught up in the things of this world and our goals and our plans, and I want this and I want that, and I'm going to be much happier if I have these things. And as one that pursued that lifestyle a long time ago, I can tell you it doesn't work. It does not work. It is not fulfilling. As soon as you start to get stuff, you want more and more stuff. It's a never-ending street. And then you end up in debt, and then you got to work even harder to pay off that debt, and it just never ends. The rich have a very difficult time putting God first and just letting go of that. And it's very clear the wealth is going to come and go. You don't know when, you don't know how. You could be rich today and poor tomorrow. Then what are you going to do? The things of God are eternal. They last forever. It's a lifetime. James gets this stuff. He understands it. Now let's look at James 1:12. Would somebody read that? Thank you so much. So we kind of go back to this whole thing of persevering during trials. After he goes through this dissertation about being humble, we learn that he says, blessed is the one who perseveres under trial. That's interesting. We never think of blessings coming with trials, do we? He says, you're blessed for going through trials. When I think of trials and persecution and struggles, I often think of Paul. He wrote 13 letters. You can see his life pretty clearly in the struggles he went through. In fact, I think it's in Hebrews where he lists them all out for us. And through all those, Paul's joyful. He's living his life as a blessed man. He doesn't count his trials as something that were hindering him in any way. He saw them as God's testing. And God always showed up in those trials. Even when he was on a jail floor, he was witnessing to people and worshiping God. It always amazed me to see Paul and saying, God, I wish I could live my life that way. I get into a situation and I'm like, oh God, why me? What I've learned is we need to say, oh God, use me. Use me in this, Father. How can you use me? The other thing is that James is reiterating Jesus' own words. Somebody read Matthew 5, 11, and 12. I think I have it in the YouVersion event.
Okay. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
Thank you so much. And we live in a world where Christians get persecuted, ridiculed, and said, you're blessed. You're blessed when that takes place. Why? This is because great is your reward in heaven. Jesus himself said that. Don't look at the insults as a personal attack on you, because it's a personal attack on Jesus. And Jesus is saying, thank you for enduring that for my sake. Because you are blessed to be counted worthy to be persecuted, because your name is written in the book of life. He says you'll have a crown of glory in the end. Now, I have not suffered a great deal of persecution. I've been in places where persecution is rampant, but I've not been the subject of persecution. Now, of course, I've had people insult me for being a Christian or insult me for my beliefs, and I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that. You're not going to see me get worked up over it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look for a door or an opportunity where I can minister to that person versus knock them down and fight back. There are so many worldviews where people are brought up in a very different environment than we are. And they're taught that Christians hate them. They're taught that we judge them. They're taught that we are hypocrites. And a lot of times it's Christians that teach them that. Cindy and I had the opportunity to go to a training course yesterday where we were taught and became certified premarital counselors. And through that, the guy that was teaching the class, he's a Christian. He does weddings for the secular as well as Christians or other beliefs. And I was kind of questioning him, you know, why he chose to do that and what his feelings were. And he was sharing with me about a young man that came to him that was going to get married, and how his fiance grew up in a church. He did not. He's actually from an Asian country. And she tried to get him to go to church one time, and they had this evangelistic SWAT team that came in and tried to push him into converting to Christianity, and it just drove him nuts. He was a very intelligent man, and he was like, bring it on. I'm going to show you why I'm not a Christian. And so they come to this man that's a pastor who's not affiliated with a church. He is a Christian man. And he said, the reason I do this is because it gives me an opportunity like no other to minister one-on-one to people that don't know Christ. He said, even if they don't accept Christ, I know I planted a seed and I'll still do their wedding. And through that, he said, I've had more conversions to Christ through this than I ever had in a church. And he was a pastor over a mega church.
I have a question, though. If you're marrying somebody, usually those vows include godly verses and words, and, you know, you're getting married in the name of God. How would you marry somebody that believe I've never.
Well, you don't have to use those verses, right? I mean, as a Christian, as a church, that's exactly what I would do. I would marry you in the name of God, and I believe that, you know, don't be unyoked with an unbeliever. I don't do many weddings, obviously, but when I do, that's very important to me. However, this guy sees it as an evangelistic tool. And he's an officiator. He's saying the vows. He said they're going to get married anyway. I'd rather have an opportunity to open that door. And he gives these people his phone number. He says, hey, just in case you want to know more about Christ or you're exploring, here's a number of a pastor you can call anytime. And he opens his door up to him. And this guy does something like 60-something weddings a year. And he's had all kinds of conversions through that, because here's a guy that's showing interest in somebody's life.
He's not judging.
He's planting a seed, and many times people come to him. And, you know, he's explaining about one person recently that called him at 4 a.m. He did their wedding. He was a secular man. There, he heard sirens going on in the background. And he's like, oh, this can't be good. And he answers the phone, or the guy starts talking to him. He says, I remember you gave me your number. My daughter just overdosed, and I don't know what to do. Who do you reach out to? This pastor. And he gave him an opportunity to just comfort them and bring Christ into their life. And so I'm like, that's awesome. That is awesome. There are many people that view the world differently than we do.
Again, I've always had the question, how do people deal with those struggles when they don't have Christ? You know, and here you go. And here you go. I think that's what causes a lot of the addiction is that you have.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Roy. So we need to be reminded that even though the world hates Christianity, most of the time they don't understand it. They're taught that God is against them. They're taught that there is no God. They've never encountered the true Jesus. And that's one thing I've learned. When you can be Jesus, truly who he is, not judgmental, but interested in bringing you into the loving understanding of who God is, it changes things. It changes things. And we need to be ready to understand that there's people that don't understand God. And they're angry towards him for one reason or another. Maybe it's because he doesn't line up with their lifestyle. But we need to be prepared to deal with that in a loving way. I never saw Jesus rebuking secular people. He always rebuked the religious leaders. Why? Because they didn't have that kind of heart. They were hypocrites. It's like, God, don't let me be one of those.
They were in it for the notoriety at the time.
Absolutely, but we have many Christians that are today too. You see, James was writing to a persecuted people. It's a persecution like we probably will never understand completely. You think people hate Christians today? They hated them back then severely. And they had laws that allowed them to throw them in jail or kill them. Even though they were scattered and running for their lives, James is saying, stay the course. Don't let these trials get you off course. Reminds me of the mesquite, the cutter I was on. We pulled up a buoy and steamed back 100 yards. We turned the ship away from this rock ledge that buoy was marking. We started steaming forward. Well, the current came in, the waves and the wind, and it started pushing our ship off a course. And next thing you know, we hit this rock ledge. spiritually that happens to us if we do not stay faithful to Christ. We have to stand firm. We need accountability in our lives. We need people to help us stay on course. You know, there are times where I'm not spending as much time with God as I should. And I start to look at those times in my life where that's the case. And I start to realize that, you know why? It's because I don't have people coming alongside of me in those times to help me. Help me to be accountable, to guide me. We all need that. Each one of us needs that, but you have to allow people in your life to do that. If you don't, you're going to get off course. You're going to get off course. There's no question about it. You know, I had Pastor James, who I love dearly, was very involved in our church early on, and I'm not sure what's happened. But we haven't been nearly as involved with him as we have in the past. And you know, he was a pastor I could go to any time. And he probably still is. We've just lost connection with one another. Then there's Pastor Will, that's a dear friend of mine. That there are times I know I can go to him and say, Pastor, well, I need you to help me through this.
Well, I think it's a transition in time too, where you had to start the church, so you needed some covering, so you went over here, and James was able to help you get on your feet and get started, and here you're walking the walk, and you're walking the walk together, and then you get to a point where it feels like you're up and walking on your own, so he's backing off, and here comes Pastor Will to pick you up from where he left you and comes to walk you the rest of the way. And I think it's a pattern that you go through. I mean, it's just me, but I think that's what it is one handing you off to the next, and which will eventually hand you on to the next.
It very well could be, Roy. That's a good point. That's wisdom that we talked about, brother. Guys, we got to stay the course. Even if we can't stay the course when we're not in the middle of a trial, how will we when we go through these trials?
I think that's where it's important to have the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, then you're not going to... We can't do it on our own.
Absolutely.
We're going to succumb to temptation because we are too weak.
Absolutely.
But instead of beating ourselves up for being too weak, I know for myself, just... recently, just more looking like when I start to feel overwhelmed, just feeling okay, it's because I'm relying on myself,
right?
And you know,
it's easy to do.
Yeah,
it's easy to do. I mean, we're fleshly people, but we're also spiritual people. And when the spirit's weak, the flesh is weak. And so we need to strengthen our spirits constantly. You know, I'm looking at the signs all around us, guys. I'm not big into end-time prophecies. I know that God's going to do whatever God decides to do when he decides to do it. But if you start to read Revelation, you read Daniel, you read Ezekiel, and you read the signs of the times, it's pretty scary. I mean, it looks like it's getting closer and closer. You know, just the world is seeing things that's never recorded before. And Jesus says, stay the course. It's coming. I'm going to come like a thief in the night. You will not know the day or hour. Will you be ready?
I'm only scared for the non-believers. I'm not scared for rapture or whatever they call it, but I'm scared for those that don't know God.
Yeah. We should be. We should be afraid for those that don't know God. This should be an urgent call to the church. I'm seeing pastor after pastor who I know isn't big into the end time prophecy saying the same things.
Israel just destroyed something in Iran, some kind of big facility of bombs or nuclear or something that lines up with all the prophecy. I mean, it's that's kind of weird that they did that, but we know it's coming. And
the Temple Mount, too. The Temple Mount is something. There's a battle between Muslims who claim the Temple Mount.
Oh, there always has been, though. That's been going on for years. The point here is we can't get relaxed in our Christian walk. All the statistics point to Christianity becoming smaller and smaller in this world. There's fewer and fewer believers in Christ. The numbers are staggering. They're lower than they've ever been in terms of the population. Church attendance is way down. Discipleship isn't taking place in many of the churches today.
But it's because the church isn't doing the work the church was meant for.
You're right. You go back to Revelation and read the woes to the seven churches. And that lines up pretty well with what we're seeing today. Jesus says, remember your first love. Remember your first love and you will receive the crown. If we live our lives for this world, guys, you're setting yourselves up for some serious trouble. Because if you read Revelation, you read what's going to take place in the end times. How are you going to survive it? How are you going to stay strong in your faith?
Well, I had a dream years ago that it was a rebuke that God was doing on me, that sin separates us from God, and we can't hear His voice when we're satisfying our flesh,
right?
And we're getting into it, and then when we get to that time of needing Him, we're not going to know direction. And in my dream, it was like I'd been pursuing my own self, and when the end times came, I was confused. I was trying to hear God then, and I couldn't hear Him.
Absolutely.
And so that's why it's important to me that we identify the sin in our lives, we kill it.
Yep.
And then we constantly commit. It's okay to fall, but we're not going to be able to hear His voice.
Absolutely.
And
what's really interesting is if you read when Satan comes to wreak havoc, he deceives the whole world. He says he even comes to deceive the elect, if that's possible. And I believe there's going to be many Christians deceived because they're not strong in their faith. They're going to give in to whatever this false Messiah comes to give. And it's a time where we need to be strengthened, guys. We shouldn't take this lightly. Your eternity is at stake. Stay strong in your faith, because the Bible is very clear that many will turn. They will turn from the teachings of Christ in the end days. Is that possible? Apparently it is. I'm going to stop us there. How many of you think we're in the end times? We're getting close. Raise hands. How many of you have studied, and I'm not trying to scare anybody here. This is not to scare you. This is to prepare to know that Christ is bigger than all of this, and He's coming for His church. We have nothing to fear other than God Himself. But we got to stay strong. We got to be prepared to stand these trials, because it's crazy. The Word says, James, I want to summarize here, that we're to be humble, right? How many epistles were written by Paul?
13.
All right. And how many epistles are in the New Testament?
21.
Look at that. It says be teachable. You're teachable. All right. We need to recognize our dependence on God, right? He's in control, folks. We need to consider others' needs above our own, right? It means to live selfless. You know, I read about the pride, and they're enemies of God. Let's not be an enemy of God. He talks about the rich, how they depend on the world's economy versus God's economy. Which economy is going to last? God's economy. We need to persevere through our trials and stay the course. And Jesus says, I have a reward for you, that those that do. It's pretty cool, huh? Persevere.
That's what Bema means. Christians are at the Bema seat judgment. Bema is a reward ceremony for what we've done in His name. That's not something I don't think we should be afraid of. I think we should be wary and know that we're working for God as servants on earth. But I don't dread the Bema seat judgment.
Well, I think if we're truly walking with Christ, then it's Christ doing the work in us. And I don't think we should be expecting any credit for anything we've done, but for allowing Christ to work in us and through us. And we give Him the honor and the glory. When we're at that seat, we're going to be worshiping God. He's not going to be worshiping us. There's going to be a throne in the center, and all these people are worshiping Him. And so our crown is to be in His presence. To be in His presence. The Bible says nobody has seen God except for the Son. There's going to be a time where we're in His presence forever. That's our crown of glory. And it's not something we've earned. It's something that He gave to us. So let me pray and we'll end there.